Hello and welcome to the very first Culture File Ebdo, or weekly as we say around these parts, the very first easy-to-download compilation of each week's daily Culture Files. This week we go into therapy with stand-up comedian Eleanor Tiernan, take fright at the airborne befana of restaurateur Giorgio Cassari, and kick over the stones of Dublin with historian Lisa Marie Griffith. But first off, we fetch up in Bantry to take a look behind the blue door of Bantry Boxing Club. Here, painter Sarah Walker has found the inspiration for her latest body of work, chronicling the life of young Irish boxers, namely her sons Seamus and Emmett, and their coach Andy Cairns. So let's step inside. No after you. No after you.
When we first rang up Andy about asking him, could he take on Seamus? Could he join the club? And he was just said, "Oh, I'm sure he's just been watching the Olympics, has he? You know." But I was like, "Oh no, wait till you meet Seamus. You know, he's wanted to do this since he was 2 years old." And then, you know, it wasn't long before Andy kind of realised the kind of commitment that Seamus was willing to make. So, anyway, he was very happy with Seamus very quickly.
Well, you have to get into the routine of going hard for 2 minutes or 3 minutes, whatever your contests are, and then resting for a minute. Do you know what? You just have to get that system into your body. Like,
when the other fella's thumping you, 2 minutes seems to go on forever. But when you're the one that's kind of being the boss, there's not enough time. But it's a long 2 minutes when you're getting the wrong end of the stick, yeah. Because there isn't too many places to hide, you know. Middle of the ring. Battle for the middle of the ring. Don't give it away. Hold the centre. Throw your shots. If you step left, you're going to lose the middle. You just have to win in it and you give it away. Don't always be the one on the outside. Come on, pick it up, tidy up the small bit, the pair is. Seamus is very graceful in the ring. And I mean, if sometimes you watch the movement, it's like, it's almost balletic. It's fantastic to see when it's done right, but that takes a long number of years. And Seamus is with me since he's 11 years old, so he's 7 years of training, looking after himself well, and he's still improving. I can remember one contest, it was 2 years ago, and it's just stuck in my mind. We were at a show, and his movement was just absolutely fantastic, and he just looked so comfortable. And I said it to him when he came back to the corner. I think it was the first time I ever said to someone, he sat down, I looked at him, he looked at me, I smiled, he smiled, and I just said, "You're boxing beautiful, baby." But it was the way he boxed, and it was beautiful to watch, you know. And someone who appreciates the game, that's what you want to see.
The show is actually called The Boxing Diaries, and Oliver came up with that title, but it's a good description of what it's about, because it's not only about the competitions and their achievements in the competitions, but I mean, so much of it is about I suppose how it's been within the family and all the distances that we've driven all over the countryside and all the time that we've spent in different towns everywhere and all these, you know, places that I'd never been to before. And, you know, you end up driving from Kilmallock and Limerick across country to Clonmel, and you're on roads that you've never been on in your life before. And you're just seeing this whole world that I knew nothing about.
This is my art, this is my passion. Like, I don't know, completely enthralled by boxing since the very start. My mother started painting boxing about 2 years ago. She just kind of said, you know, once at dinner, I'm starting to get into painting pictures of you boxing now, James. I suppose she was just so, like, in the whole scene of boxing all the time, with myself and Emmett in the championships and everything, I just thought, well, that's great, like.
Steps. That's one of Seamus's deadly punches.
Yeah, that's very representative, actually. It's exactly the way he throws
one
it, isn't it?
Great scores.
That long right hand.
That's the hook at the end.
I like that one, the shadows. The one before that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's one of the ones. There's a couple of, actually, you in the corner.
Certain boxers. Well, nearly all of them. It's like a signature punch, almost. There's certain punches that they can just execute a lot better than others. One of his better ones is that he just fires it because he's very rangy and he's quite quick, and he throws it, I call it a long right hand, because it's his backhand that comes from behind, but it just travels like a javelin, really. It's just long, fast and straight, and more often than not always on target, and he just throws it particularly well. But it's just the shape, which Sarah's encapsulated that perfectly in the painting, the way that he throws it. I mean, I could tell straight away that was Seamus.
That's what I felt.
Yeah, okay. Have another look. Just see what you're... Or, Oliver, you have another look. Just see what you think about
the
colours.
You think this is a colour issue?
Yeah, I was just thinking, was it a bit...
bland?
Was it a bit kind of soft? Or you think it's okay? So we're actually hanging today. We're in the gallery, the Oliver Sears Gallery. And we are being ruthless and just making sure that we don't overhang. So we're trying to put everything together. It's quite tricky. You think it's going to be easy, but it never is. But I think it's coming together now. Yeah, it's looking good.
Oh, I think that's a lot better. I think that really works, actually. It does, yeah. Because it's the blues are bouncing in a good way.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. I suppose, actually, when I was doing the boxing paintings, it was very kind of just something that I really felt like doing. I never thought of it as something that people would pick up on. And when I was first showing Oliver some of my work, I was showing him the kind of work that I would usually do and that people would know, that people would associate my work with. But he just was interested in the boxing paintings, and I was kind of delighted because they were very personal. I mean, maybe that's what makes them, you know, intriguing, engaging, is the fact that they are very personal. I mean, obviously they're very personal because they're about my own sons.
Thank you very much.
For me, watching the boxing, it's more a whole combination of emotions and sensitivity, behavior, you know, that whole thing between the trainers and the kids, nurturing and the care and the attention given to them, and then the whole respect between the refs and the kids. And it doesn't really feel like a whole environment of aggression. It really feels more to do with how to carry out this sport, and that's what I find really interesting about a sport as a form of youth training, because it teaches them every lesson that they need to learn growing up. You know, I mean, from the very beginning, Andy has kind of trained the kids to thank me for driving them to training, you know, little things like that. And they do that now. They really are aware of all elements of what they're doing, you know, which is fantastic. The bleeding in the club is always just a nosebleed, you know, and Seamus has been really prone to nosebleeds over the years. So, and actually the nosebleeds are means that a contest can be stopped because of a nosebleed, because they're very careful about not transmitting blood.
Have you painted the blood into any of the pictures?
No, I haven't actually done that. Yeah, I never even thought about that, actually.
Because, you know, I was thinking of the lads there, they were doing their bit of painting around the floor with the blood. It's kind of like 60s style performance work.
No, they were not. No. Sometimes, though, I'd come in at the end of training and Seamus would be holding up a towel that was covered in blood, and I'd just go, oh my God.
painter Sarah Walker on her boxing diaries. And from Bantry we head to Ball's Bridge to celebrate Nollaig na mBan, or Befana, as Ireland's top Italian restaurateur Giorgio Cesari likes to call it. He talked to Culturefile about some of the night's special dishes and offered a possibly more serious culinary epiphany about the correct uses of panettone.
Hello, welcome to Marseille. Please come in. Table for two. Well, home is near Milano, just outside Milano, in a beautiful town where the main square was designed by Leonardo da Vinci, so beautiful historic old town. And Christmas Day was very, very important, obviously. We always went to the Christmas midnight mass, you know, the night before. In Italy, the law is different. The bars are open, especially that night, so they're waiting for people to leave mass to offer them a slice of panettone and a glass of Prosecco. So it's quite late by the time you go to bed. And in the morning, we don't really have the Santa Claus tradition per se. We call it baby Jesus, Jesus Bambino. What did Jesus Bambino bring you? I don't know literally why that is, but we obviously have visuals of Santa Claus everywhere, you know, thanks to the media. New Year's Eve was obviously a big celebration, but more for adults. We didn't really feel it as children. And then the 6th of January came. We don't call it a Christmas, we call it Epifania, Epiphany. Epiphany literally means 12 days since Christmas, and that's literally what it is. And Epifania is a Befana. It's represented visually as a Befana. A Befana is a friendly witch. She may not look friendly in visual representation, but she is a friendly witch who traditionally flies on a broomstick and delivers black coal to bad children and white candies to good children. The reality is everybody gets black coal in forms of a candy color with some sort of caramel because occasionally everybody has been bad during the year in children view. So therefore everybody gets black coal, good and bad children. She flies on a broomstick, it goes back to a legend, Christian tradition. She was a housewife, an old lady, who her house was on the path of the three kings going to honor Jesus when he was born. And they stopped in her house, and she was very kind and gave them food and something hot to drink on their path to the walk. They invited her to follow them to see baby Jesus, and she refused because she had too much homework to do. When they left, she was really, really sorry over a bad decision, and she spent the rest of her life trying to find the three kings and the baby Jesus. And therefore, every house, she started this long walk looking for baby Jesus. She never found him. She's still looking for him, that's the belief. And she had little gift for every house that she encountered on a path where there was a child, because that child could have been baby Jesus. That's the believer tradition. There is another tradition, the agnostic tradition, the non-believer tradition, which I do prefer. The Befana, the old witch, symbolizes Mother Earth, the soil. The soil at the end of the year is tired, there's nothing left, there's no minerals, nothing left. And the little gifts are the seeds. The seeds will give new life to the soil, so it's a new beginning. And I do prefer this. Although I am a believer, I prefer the non-believer legend. La Befana also symbolizes the end of all festivities, so it's the day where you stop overeating and overindulging in gluttony and start your sort of healthy regime.
Hey guys, coming in 2 soup, 2 pork, 4 salmon, 3 goat and a foie gras, followed by 5 venison, 3 cakes, 3 chicken, lamb, sides.
Yes. But really the original panettone is so beautifully fragrant and so full of butter and fruit that you really don't need anything. And if you just slice it, put it in the oven or under a grill for a couple of minutes, it becomes crispy. The whole house is smelling of butter. It's fantastic. And then you can put a little touch of Irish mist, Grand Marnier, Cointreau on top. And if you really want to go in the indulgence path, then you can put a lovely bowl of vanilla ice cream on top. It's the best dessert in the world. I know you guys, some of the Irish chefs now are using panettone to do bread and butter pudding. It's fantastic, but it's so rich. Panettone is rich by itself, By doing the bread and butter pudding, you're adding cream and eggs, and the whole thing becomes like a brick on your stomach. I don't think that's right. The castrated cock. It's hard to buy a real one. It's very, very expensive. And the traditional way is to boil it, not to roast it. Obviously, it's very good roasted, but my mother always boiled it and served with mostard fruit, you know, the spicy fruit. Mostard fruit is basically fruit that is cooked in mustard seeds, wine, and there's so many different ingredients. The recipe is quite secret. It comes from Cremona, which is halfway between Milan and Verona. Some of the fruits are very, very spicy. But again, traditionally, mostard fruit was only for Christmas. I don't know the actual factory, what they did the rest of the year, you know. But now it's gone so commercially that it's 12 months of the year. And it's absurd that we're eating mustard fruit in Italy, sometimes in Liguria or by the Riviera, sitting in 30, 35 degrees when it was designed to be a winter warming spice to add to meat, to take the fat off. But anyway, capone was beautiful dish, beautiful dish. And yeah, well, there was either capone or goose or duck, you know, my family relations at the farm. So we always got chicken that you could shake it as many times as you wanted, the meat did not come off. The eggs were naturally yellow, not because of some coloring in the food. You know, although we lived in a small city, all my relations were farmers outside of the city, so we always got some fantastic produce. But this is still very much alive in Italy today, very, very much. Searching for the genuine food, you know.
How long is two carbonara?
Ciao, ciao. Giorgio Cassari there on Keeping Epifania Special. Eleanor Tiernan specialises in comedy with a pan so dead you might feel inclined to administer CPR. So when Tiernan announced last year a national therapy project to help Ireland through its current trauma, you might have thought the treatment would be available on the medical card, which it isn't yet. For Culturefile fellow stand-up Garaud Farrelly attempted to discern therapy from comedy and answer the question on everyone's lips. Sure aren't we grand?
Why does Ireland need therapy? Aren't we grand? Take a moment to consider the potato. You are ready to begin the National Therapy Project.
Recently, I received a letter from an alleged government body known as the National Identity Management Agency, informing me that I was due to take part in a compulsory healing session as part of the National Therapy Project. I was wary of the concept of national healing, so I spoke to the project manager of the programme, comedian Eleanor Tiernan, about what she describes as an NCT for the Irish psyche.
I was actually away myself in Australia, suffering from jet lag, you know, and a bit kind of cranky and all that, and found myself one day in the Gallery of Modern Art in Brisbane. And there's a whole section within that gallery, or there was at the time, dedicated to Aboriginal art and the expression of the anger that the Aboriginal people felt that they had suffered throughout the year of their displacement. And I thought it was a wonderful way to articulate that anger, and it was a very dignified response. And at the time, I was following the news in Ireland, and the Anglo tapes came out.
Yes.
Which were, and I really felt very humiliated as a citizen of Ireland because of those tapes and the fact that the story had gone so public internationally. And the two things came together in my mind, and I thought, wouldn't it be a wonderful thing to try and address the trauma Ireland had suffered in the previous 10 years or so, and all connected with the Anglo tapes, and try to address and heal that through an artistic response.
So was the National Therapy Project, was that your idea?
Well, no, I can't say that because I was having all of these feelings and ideas, but Then in the middle of the night, I got a phone call from a voice that I didn't recognise, and they asked me if I was Eleanor Tiernan, and I was very suspicious initially, obviously. But then they said that I had been identified as a person who could be of service to my country and would have come in to government offices and have a discussion with them about what we might do about the problem of Ireland.
Why do you think they chose a comedian?
Well, it does seem like a funny choice. I'll give you that. But it actually, in fairness, when you think about it, stand-up comedian is actually an excellent choice to be a healer of a country. Stand-up comedians have to hold the sensitivities of large groups of people and, you know, kind of manage all of that in a live context. So we're actually very poised, very much poised to do that.
And the National Therapy Project, is it compulsory?
It is. It's a compulsory project, so there are penalties for people who don't go. Like, you go on a voluntary basis, I'm not saying that, but you will be penalised if you don't go. At the end of the course, what we do is we provide people with a certificate of competency, and that's something that you should keep in your wallet and have it to produce to a member of the Gardaí if at any time you're asked for it. So sometimes, like going to the Electric Picnic or you know, going to a football game in Croke Park, that's the kind of time that you might be asked for it.
After my therapy session, Eleanor brought me through the sensory healing section, where citizens are exposed to a collection of artefacts connected to Irish trauma. And a word of warning, this was heavy stuff. So we're standing here in front of something that I suppose is quite central to what you were talking about. Can you just describe
what you're looking
what
at?
We're seeing? Yeah.
There, Garode. That is the boarding card from Roy Keane's trip home from Saipan. Roy was very generous and donated that to the project, and that is probably the piece that brings up the most emotion for people when they see that. A lot of people would, you know, come to tears or have an emotion, very strong emotional response to seeing that particular piece of Irish history.
I mean, it's very stark. It's quite striking.
It is. And you know, we're very sensitive in how we treat it. You know, we're very careful with how it's stored and how it's managed. You know, we take this stuff kind of thing very seriously.
Yeah, we can see. I mean, it's protected behind glass here. Something that's not protected behind glass is this an engine?
It would look like that, I'm sure, an engine. However, what you're looking at there is this is the debris of a failed Irish space mission that was tried by a number of farmers in Ireland in the 1960s. Inspired by Neil Armstrong's walk on the moon, a number of Irish farmers tied together, you know, some pieces from some agricultural machinery, and they made their own spaceship. Now, it didn't actually ever take off, but it's something that would have been covered in the news at the time. I suppose it really gave people a lot of hope. In your hand, you have a potato. I encourage you to ask the potato for strength. Potato can be a weapon we can throw it at intruders. Or asking everybody to come to a live therapy healing session. There'll be one of them in your locality, and what we're hoping is people come in and they get a short blast of therapy, and that will heal them. It'll rid them of some of the neurosis, the kind of twisted problems that we have in the Irish psyche. So it's a kind of a citizen improvement scheme. Irish people have a weird relationship with America, and when American tourists come to Ireland, we can be quite hard on them. We can laugh at them, you know, for their desire to try and, you know, reconnect with their past, their relatives, look up their Irish heritage. Like, why would we do that? What do we get out of it? What are we so afraid of? Are we worried that they will, that there's only so much Irishness to go around, that they're going to steal Irishness from us in some way? So what for that situation, what we have is affirmations. The act of saying these affirmations changes you emotionally. So one of the things that you might say is out loud is there is more than enough Irishness for everyone. That would be a statement that people make in the show. The reason I was called in by the government is because they had done a study, a big study called the National Psyche Strategy Study. That study had identified a number of key defects in the Irish psyche. One of them would be that we have the listening skills of a toddler suffering from the whooping cough. Another one would be that we have the tendency to believe in the correctness of our own point of view. It's the same in an Irish person as it is in certain third world African dictators. So we're quite off the scale in terms of our ability to function. And this is a way to just coax the Irish psyche back into within safe limits.
What qualifications do you have to deliver these courses?
None whatsoever, Garrod. So in that way, it is quite difficult for me because I end up, you know, just not really knowing what I'm talking about or what I'm doing.
And obviously, it's most important to get across that attendance is compulsory.
Yeah, on a voluntary basis.
Eleanor Tiernan there guiding Garrod Farrelly towards enlightenment. Now, Lisa Marie Griffith is a historian and author of Stones of Dublin, a history that somewhere between figuratively and literally lifts the roof off some of the capital's most storied structures. When we went to visit her at the National Print Museum, she wanted to explode some national myths, starting with the story that Crow Park's Hill 16 was built from the rubble of the GPO. But that one's true, actually, isn't it?
Actually, that's not true. If you look at the early years of the GAA, we know that the GAA had lots of very politically active nationalists involved in it. And many of these men who got involved in the GAA would have been members of the Irish Volunteers. And of course, in 1914, John Redmond encouraged these Irish volunteers to enlist in the British Army and to go and to fight and defend Home Rule. And thousands of them did. And as a result, lots of GAA members also went to fight in World War I. So Hill 16 was originally named Hill 60 rather than Hill 16. And it was named in honour of these Irish volunteers who died during the Battle of Gallipoli, taking 60 metres. And this was a battle that was an absolute disaster from the British side. Thousands and thousands of Irish and British soldiers died, and it was a huge tragedy. And one of the pieces that I came across was when news finally comes to Dublin that so many people have been lost in this battle, and everybody's talking about it, and everyone has a relative who died in this battle. So the GAA went out of their way to honour these Irish volunteers who had been members of the GAA, and they called the hill Hill 60 rather than Hill 16. And initially the GAA wanted to stay away from a lot of the politics of the 1916 Rising, and they could see how divisive it was becoming. But after a time, they realised that their sympathies really lay with the nationalists, and it's a couple of years later that they begin to allow nationalists to have their meetings in Croke Park, and the name then gets changed from Hill 60 to Hill 16 to kind of reflect these new allegiances. One of the stories that I really like about Kilmaine Jail is about Charles Stewart Parnell's time there. So everybody imagines today that green has always been the colour of nationalism, and it's our national colour, and everybody dresses St. Patrick in green. But actually the original colour of nationalism was blue, and the Irish flag would have been blue with a harp emblazoned on it. And green actually came about because the United Irishmen used green as their colour. So green was very much associated with nationalists. And when Charles Stewart Parnell was in Kilmainham Jail, he was sent a huge amount of gifts to kind of make his time there a bit more comfortable. And apparently these gifts in particular came from lots of women. So he would be sent like kind of silk caps that, you know, they had handmade and hand embroidered his monogram into them. And apparently he got some green stockings as well. And one woman in particular sent him this very elaborate green kind of duvet that was kind of trimmed with gold, that must have really spent her a huge amount of time and money producing this. Unfortunately, what people did not know, and I think what Charles Stewart Parnell was afraid to say publicly, is that he hated the colour green. He absolutely hated it. So one account of his time there is about him shoving this beautiful green duvet that had been made for him into a wardrobe to hide it because he couldn't look at it. And supposedly someone once explained to him that actually blue had been the original colour of the Irish. And he said, blue is almost worse because it's half green.
Lisa Marie Griffith bringing this inaugural Culture File Weekly to a close, and we'll be doing it all again in the coming weeks, so don't forget to tune in or click on to RTE Lyric FM at 5:40 p.m. each weekday. And for lots more show information, follow us on Twitter at Culture File Pod. Bye now.